Like the federal government has to deal with Social Security and Medicare as its elephant in the room. Our elephant in the room financially is this unfunded pension liability that we will deal with.
Governor Parnell releases a lean state budget proposal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the search for a new superintendent in Anchorage is down to two candidates.
Both of these are great leaders, and they both have proven experience as superintendents.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Governor Parnell today presented his versions of the operating and capital projects budgets that the legislature will work on during next year's session. Speaking to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, he said lawmakers shouldn't expect to spend more in their versions of the budgets that he approved than he approved when he signed the current budgets last spring. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Parnell says the new budgets reflect $600 million in spending cuts and the elimination of 284 state jobs. He says he will not allow spending to spike just because there's surplus money available.
With that lower starting point on dollars and positions, we can have a public conversation with the legislature about needs versus wants, about efficiencies, and about more effective use of the public's dollars.
The budget leaves a $3.7 billion unspent surplus over projected revenue. But Parnell says that needs to join the $13 billion already in various state savings funds. He called for restraints against an uncertain future.
Oil production is declining, and oil prices can be volatile. The European debt crisis threatens not only Europe, but the United States, potentially heading into recession in 2012. And certainly our own federal fiscal situation and our $15 trillion national debt is reason for concern. Alaska, on the other hand, will lead in fiscal responsibility. We do not set a lower starting point for our spending that we will overspend and create more vulnerability for ourselves as a state down the road.
Parnell says he's holding the operating budget at low levels despite several sizable, unavoidable increases, such as new state employee contracts, the planned opening of the new Goose Creek prison in the Mat-Su, increased state contributions to cover Medicaid costs, and the unfunded pension liability for state employees.
Like the federal government has to deal with Social Security and Medicare as its elephant in the room, our elephant in the room financially is this unfunded pension liability that we will deal with.
Meeting with reporters following the speech, Parnell said one extra he's looking for is a $350 million package of projects to pay for improvements to ports in communities around the state. $200 million of that will go to complete the renovation underway at the Port of Anchorage. He explains that he wants to put the projects before the public as general obligation bonds, not to pay for them with cash.
Our savings accounts are making more money than the cost to finance this $350 million. So where we have to pay 3% on geo bond financing, but we're making 5%, 6%, and in some cases even more in some of our savings accounts, it makes sense to use this other cheaper money and make more on our savings. So we'll have that discussion with the legislature.
Other projects in the bond package include $110 million for a port in the Mat-Su borough and $10 million each for work on ports in Ammonick, Ketchikan, and Seward. House Minority Leader Beth Curtula points out that the governor does not allow for any inflationary costs in his spending plan. She says that'll be especially difficult for schools, since the governor's budget amounts to a decrease in spending power for local districts. The budget bills will be formally introduced at the start of the legislative session that begins January 17th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The 284 state jobs being eliminated in the governor's budget proposal are vacant positions. The intention is to help the state more easily absorb positions for the new prison slated to come online. The U.S. Senate voted to confirm Judge Morgan Christen today to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The tally was 95-3. The no votes came from conservative Republican Senators Jim DeMint of South Carolina, Rand Paul of Kentucky, and David Vitter of Louisiana. Alaska Senator sang her praises this morning on the Senate floor before the vote. Republican Lisa Murkowski noted the barrier-breaking significance Christen's seating would be.
This is really, Mr. President, an historic nomination. Only two Alaskans have had an opportunity to serve on the Ninth Circuit, and both of those judges were somewhat predictably men.
Christen has been a justice on the Alaska Supreme Court. She had bipartisan support from the Alaska delegation to move to the Ninth Circuit. The seat on the Ninth Circuit has been vacant for 18 months since Judge Andrew Kleinfeld took senior status. The circuit has jurisdiction over much of the West, including Alaska, California, Washington, and Montana. The federal office that's coordinating plans for an Alaska natural gas pipeline project takes a huge hit in a spending bill unveiled by the U.S. House overnight. The Office of the Federal Coordinator would get $1 million in funding, a cut from about $4 million. The 75% reduction would mean a major reorganization of the office, according to its head, Larry Pursley. The office has staff in Washington and Anchorage. The funding for the Gasline Coordinator's Office is part of a massive $1 trillion omnibus spending bill House Republicans unveiled just before midnight yesterday. It would fund the government through 2012. Democrats in the Senate have not yet signed off on the package, but there's pressure to pass it and avoid a government shutdown this weekend. Right now, the government is only funded through tomorrow. Community health aides across Norton Sound learned today that they could lose their jobs if they go ahead with a strike on Monday. But health aides in all 15 villages say the strike is still on if two supervisors are not removed from their roles. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
The Health Aid Association heard back from the board this morning. According to Sharon Johnson, the group's president, the Norton Sound board is arguing that the association is not recognized as the collective bargaining representative, and if a strike goes forward, employees would be subject to penalties up to termination of employment. Johnson says the health aide's position stays the same. They want the administration to remove the director of Village Health Services, Barbara Collins, and her supervisor, Mary David.
You know, if this strike happens, it's because they weren't able to terminate them. But as for now, the strike is on, and the strike will be on if they're not terminated by Monday morning at 8 a.m.
Norton Sound Health Corporation CEO Devin Parlicker says because it is an internal personnel issue, he is not able to comment. Johnson says the news this morning that the administration is prepared to fire health aides who strike dampened some enthusiasm, but it was not for long.
And I got a lot of second guesses, doubts. But now that they know that, you know, everyone needs to stand up to this and make sure that we have our issues being addressed. So far, it's turning out fantastic. I am very proud of my health aides.
The Health Aid Association says that Collins, the director of Village Health Services, has made employment conditions intolerable for employees, with 70% of the workforce having quit or been fired since Collins took the position a year and a half ago. Aides say Collins and Norton Sound leadership have failed to provide for employees following critical incident care, leading to post-traumatic stress disorder, and on to self-medication and even suicide. They also cite labor practices that misuse their vacation time. 4 days before a possible strike, Johnson says she has not been in contact with the board or administration outside of a fax from the board of directors and a company-wide message from the CEO. She says despite not being recognized as a collective bargaining group, the health aides are in a position to make their needs known.
We as health aides, you know, need to stick together, and if they don't recognize us as an association, then we ourselves can recognize ourselves as an association. We know what we can do, and we're doing it.
Johnson says aides will continue to do emergency care during a work stoppage, but will not see regularly scheduled patients. Health aides are the only providers in many communities. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an adventurer is back for another attempt at a Denali record.
You get home for a few days and you forget about the hardship. I can get my head around it because it's a fairly short expedition. It's under a month long.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The search for the next Anchorage School District superintendent is down to two finalists. Today, the board announced the names and described the final selection process, which includes a community forum with each candidate. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The two finalists are Steve Atwater, current superintendent of the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, and Jim Broder, former superintendent of Lee County School District in Fort Myers, Florida. School Board President Gretchen Guess revealed the names at a press event that was watched by about 100 school district employees.
We got over 150 applications, and we went through and we rated all the candidates, and the whole board rated. We didn't have the search firm rate or provide finalists. We did that work ourselves.
Atwater, or Browder, will replace Carol Como, who served as Anchorage superintendent since 2000 and has been with the district for over 30 years. In June, Como announced she will retire at the end of this school term. Guests said, as superintendents, the two finalists share some professional qualities.
Both of these are great leaders. They both have implemented RTI, which is our number one priority in the district, and they both have proven experience as superintendents.
RTI stands for Response to Instruction, a new system that the school board is implementing in various basic disciplines. If the two candidates possess the similar qualities cited by Guess, several differences also exist. From his Kenai location, Atwater is familiar with Alaska and the Anchorage School District. But as a past superintendent of an 80,000-student district, Browder has administrative experience closer to Anchorage's 50,000-student range. The Kenai Peninsula Borough School District lists between 9 to 10,000 students. The Fort Myers area contains greater ethnic and racial variety than Kenai, although guests stressed both superintendents have worked with programs for low-income students, an important point for the Anchorage School Board. The next step is to bring both candidates to Anchorage. Broder will be here during the first week in January, Atwater the second week.
During their on-site interviews, they're going to be out in our schools, meeting with our students, meeting with our principals, meeting with the leadership, the assembly, and the mayor. They're going to have time on talk radio. They're going to have time with the press. They're going to have two interviews with the school board, one at the beginning and one at the end.
Also during their Anchorage visits, Atwater and Broder will take part in community forums where the public can participate or watch on the district's television channel. Guest said one topic certain to arise is what the pair did to improve No Child Left Behind progress requirements during their previous tenures as superintendents.
We are going to ask them to bring forward in the on-site interview, and we're going to be discussing much more in the on-site about what did you do regarding student performance at your last position.
Board President Guest declined to describe the salary offering, other than to say it will probably be higher than Como's, which is $165,000 plus benefits. Como's salary is among the lowest in the nation for a district the size of Anchorage. Current plans call for the new superintendent to be selected in mid-January, with the contract finalized by month's end. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Who should profit from the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands crab fisheries? That was the big question at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting over the weekend. Answering it generated more than 6 hours of public testimony and resulted in a vote that split the council. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
At the heart of the debate over who should reap the benefits of crabbing is a practice called quota leasing. Crab fishing used to be a race. There was a set amount that could be taken, and vessels competed to get as many pounds as possible before it all ran out. 6 years ago, fisheries managers switched over to a system that distributed shares of the harvest to vessel owners based on how much they had caught historically. For many owners, the share they received wasn't big enough to make fishing profitable. Others simply didn't want to be a part of the industry anymore. The result was a massive consolidation of the crab fleet. 230 boats fished Bristol Bay red king crab in 2001. This year, only 62 fished. But many of the owners who no longer have vessels that fish for crab still own crab shares. They lease those shares to active boats in exchange for part of the profits. Anecdotal evidence suggests that in some fisheries, like Bristol Bay, more than half of the total harvest is leased. Quota holders in that fishery charge boats up to 70% for the right to fish their shares. What that potentially means is that some quota holders receive large profits from their shares without assuming any of the risk of owning a vessel or actually catching crab. Counselor Sam Cotton described it as collecting rent when he asked crabber Tyler Schmiel whether the practice bothered him.
Do you care if the people that you lease your quota from are active in the fishery? Do you care if they live in Singapore and just do nothing but collect rents? Does it make any difference to you as part of your business? Does it offend you in any way as a matter of policy?
Schmiel said it didn't bother him, and so did crabber Brian Hayworth, who also testified.
To hear that owners of the boats are sitting on beaches in tropical location receiving checks that only most of us can ever dream of doesn't really faze me. It's, you know, good for them. They were truly the ones that took the financial risk of owning their boats, dealing with crews, dealing with the insurance companies, before the IQ programs. And I mean, most of these guys, I mean, they pioneered the industry.
Other fishermen and some counselors felt very differently about who should benefit. Tom Surian is skipper of the Bristol Mariner. He testified that high lease rates take money out of crew members' pockets.
We know traditionally where we started before rationalization. There's tremendous data to show that. We know where we are now. And we also know that there's a trend downward that as over time, especially as more and more crab is leased and there's royalties assigned to that, that it seems to be coming out of the crew share.
Counselor Dan Hall said he didn't see any incentive for quota holders to ever sell their shares and let new people into the industry if they could just keep collecting returns.
The only reason that a corporation might sell, as far as I can see, is that if the revenues earned from that quota would be less than what they could earn it by investing it in something else.
As it stands, the data on leasing and how it actually affects crew pay and quota turnover is scarce. A motion introduced by Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell asks for more analysis of the issues. The motion, which passed by one vote, calls for the council to consider an active participation requirement for the fishery and commissions a study that examines lease rate caps, crew compensation, and quota sales. The council is expected to take up the issue again sometime next year. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Sponsors of a citizens initiative to reestablish the Alaska Coastal Management Program are frustrated by the Parnell administration's apparent foot dragging. The state still hasn't given initiative backers the pamphlets they need to begin collecting signatures. The Division of Elections is awaiting cost estimates from the Lieutenant Governor's Office and the Office of Management and Budget. Initiative co-sponsor Kodiak Island Borough Mayor Jerome Selby says it shouldn't take this long to figure out how much it will cost to run a program that just closed down in July.
Seems like every opportunity to delay, that they take that opportunity and it reduces our amount of time to be able to collect the signatures. Give the people in the state of Alaska the chance to have a voice in an important program.
Selby says sponsors were initially led to believe the booklets would be available last week. The latest delay comes after Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell took the full 60 days to review the initiative application. Treadwell's Deputy Chief of Staff, Barbara Propes, says the cost estimate has taken longer than expected due to the Office of Management and Budget preparing the governor's 2013 spending plans released today. She also says the coastal management program outlined in the initiative is more complex than the one that shut down earlier this year.
We're looking at the changes, and that's what the department heads, were told to do and need to do by law, and to see where and if there were any changes, and to make sure that we have dollars assigned. And that's basically pretty routine. I mean, we got it from law. We sent it to OMB. They're looking at it. We're looking to make sure that we have all the costs covered, and then we'll get it to print.
Propes says her best guess is that the final cost report will be headed to Division of Elections in the next 2 days. Sponsors are hoping to collect about 26,000 signatures by the start of the legislative session on January 17th. That would guarantee the initiative a spot on the fall 2012 statewide ballot and give lawmakers an opportunity to enact substantially similar legislation instead. Lonnie Dupre is back in Alaska for a second attempt at climbing Denali solo in the month of January. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a Russian team got climbers to the summit of Denali in January 1998, but no solo expedition has ever succeeded in scaling the peak in the coldest, darkest part of winter.
Lonnie Dupre endured a week-long stay in a tiny snow cave he carved out at the mountain's 17,000-foot level last January. The 50-year-old Minnesota adventurer with over two decades of Arctic experience was thwarted by high winds in his first try at the unprecedented feat. Dupre was forced to retreat, but says after returning home, decided to give it another shot.
You get home for a few days and you forget about the hardship. I can get my head around it because it's a fairly short expedition. It's under a month long, and whereas most of my other projects have been, I think the shortest is 2 months long and some up to 8 months long to stretch. So I can get my head around Denali, and you can also kind of see what you're up against. You can see pretty much your entire route.
Dupre says the weather will ultimately determine whether he makes it to the top of North America's highest peak, but that he's made some changes to his gear to decrease the load he starts out with from 150 pounds to 110.
I'm taking a little less food. I've refined my diet a little bit, and a lot of my I'm going with about a pound and a third of food, of dehydrated food a day. I'm going with a little bit lighter equipment, sled, climbing equipment. Everything's just a smidgen lighter.
Dupre says he'll haul enough supplies to spend 34 days on the mountain. One of the biggest risks of solo climbing is falling into a crevasse. Without a partner to pull you out, it can be a one-way trip. But Dupre says his travel setup minimizes risk. It includes an aluminum ladder to span crevasses and special skis.
I have some custom-made birch skis out of my hometown of Grand Marais. Fairly wide, 7-foot-long skis to give me flotation and to span crevices as I'm working my way up the Kahiltna. And then I'll leave my skis at 11,200 feet, where I'll then just go on with crampons up to 14 with my ladder still. And then from 14, just carry on with a backpack.
Dupre plans to veer from the standard West Buttress route on the last portion of the climb, opting for a more direct but technical pitch that leads to Zebra Rocks at about 19,000 feet, and then carry on another 1,000 feet to the summit from there. Dupre is scheduled to fly onto the Kahiltna Glacier to start the climb December 21st. Dupre will carry satellite and cell phones to provide regular updates for his website. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The local college campus in Bristol Bay is asking area residents for a little piece of their Christmas tree. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Christmas holiday is just around the corner, and residents across the Bristol Bay region are getting ready to celebrate. As part of Christmas, many people in the region put up a Christmas tree that is normally a small spruce tree that they cut down themselves. The Environmental Studies Program at the UAF Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham is asking area residents to save a little piece of their tree and send it in for analysis. Todd Radenbaugh is the Assistant Professor of Environmental Science with the Bristol Bay Environmental Science Laboratory. He's asking residents in the region for a small one-inch slice from the base of their Christmas tree.
So we can do a science called dendrochronology and look at different growing conditions and how old Christmas trees are.
The Bristol Bay Environmental Science Laboratory was created back in 2007 with a mission of increasing science literacy and providing the knowledge and skills necessary for people to take an active role in the management of the natural resources in and around Bristol Bay. Adam Kane is the Bristol Bay campus's science education liaison, and he says the new project, called the Great Christmas Tree Challenge, will build on some tree samples collected this past summer.
And so we have some trees that are 2 or 3 inches across and 130 years old. And I mean, diameter. They're tiny trees, but really old. And so I thought, well, you know, now's a good time. People are cutting down a lot of trees. Let's get a sample of what people are cutting down. So it started as a science experiment, and it just happened to be the right time of year.
Kane confirms that in addition to simply collecting samples of Christmas trees, the Bristol Bay campus's environmental studies program is also reaching out to area public schools.
The reason I sent it to science teachers is because I think it's a good thing that they could talk about during class. But if it's not something they don't have time for, or the end of the year is coming up, and I know that, we'll take samples from anyone.
Along with the actual sample of the Christmas tree, the environmental studies program is looking for additional information about the tree. Kane is asking area residents to provide a measurement of the height of the tree, among other things.
We want the location that it was cut down in, if possible. We'd like to know, ideally, the height of the tree altogether. And again, if it's an estimate, then it's an estimate, and that's all right. We'd like to know the growing conditions, such as, is the tree that you cut down in the middle of a forest? Is it surrounded by a lot of trees? Is it on the edge of a forest? Is it facing north or south or east or west? Does it have, you know, because if it's on the north side of a group of trees and it's right on the edge, so it probably gets less sun than one on the south side, and so it probably grows differently.
A one-inch slice from the base of a small Christmas tree can provide a wealth of information about the life history of the tree, and Radenbaugh says that in turn can provide information about the surrounding environment.
It can tell you how much precipitation occurred that year, or at least give you an indication of precipitation being wet or dry year, and it can tell you a bit about temperature for that particular year.
In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.